On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Immigration Museum for today's Conversation Hour, and thank you all for coming along. Thank you all very much. A heavily rehearsed and contrived round of applause to kick off our discussions here at Melbourne's Immigration Museum. They have a new exhibition that's opened. It's about Mahatma Gandhi, and his granddaughter, Ela, will join us as one of our guests here on stage at the Immigration Museum in just a moment. But to kick off proceedings, my co-host is the General Manager of the Immigration Museum, Rohini Kapadat. And Rohini, thank you very much for making us so welcome.
Thank you, John, for being here.
I've not been greeted with a cup of tea at the door at any other broadcast that I've ever done. So you're already way ahead, I might say, on the hospitality stage.
Well, we must get you some biscuits then.
No, I've choked on biscuits on air. I don't recommend it. Now, tell us about this incredible exhibition, which is a digital exploration of the life of one of recent history's most remarkable people.
Indeed, it's a real honour and privilege to be telling this wonderful, timeless story of Mahatma Gandhi. And then, to top that, to be bringing a living treasure into this city of ours in Ela Gandhi. Of course, we'll be hearing from her a little bit later. But this is part of the museum's transformation into a living, vibrant, multicultural space that celebrates the rich diversity of our city. So we couldn't be more honoured, John.
I'm a bit embarrassed because we're quite literally bursting at the seams here in your grand hall. Describe this room for us. I hate to admit this, but this is my second visit ever to the Immigration Museum and my first since the day you opened.
You know, you're ahead of a number of people because most people haven't visited at all. We think this is a hidden treasure in our country. This is an iconic space. And if you look at the grandeur of this room alone, the long room, this is the place where a couple of 100 years ago, the boats would come into our, on the bay. They'd drop their goods and customs duties were paid in this very room. So you're sitting in a piece of history. It's a rather awe-inspiring space, isn't it?
So this building was the customs house, this hall. It's sort of like Ellis Island in the middle of New York Harbour. This is the floor on which new arrivals trod. Wherever in the world they disembarked from, this is the room they would have gone through.
That's right. And in fact, there's a lovely story about the tiles in this room, because when about 50-odd years ago, when the tiles were being replaced, the Immigration Museum actually rang the company that had the original tiles, and they actually had the original order from the 1800s sitting with them. And this is the same tile that was used many, many years ago.
It's because they'd never been paid. So this is a tessellated tiled floor, but the building itself, describe, other than just the room we're in now, what else? There are other chambers and delights in here.
Yes, we have a number of exhibitions that speak about belonging, that speak about identity, about the notion of difference. We have spaces that enable you to have safe conversations that are typically difficult conversations. But, we have a wonderful discovery centre downstairs. In fact, that's a public information service that's available free to the public. The public can walk into the museum each and every day at no cost and actually trace back their history of their ancestors. So there, we have a theatreette, we have about 50,000 school students coming here each year. So this is very much an institution that's part of the Victorian school curriculum. And the kids love the museum. We just wish that they would go home and then tell their parents and then bring their parents back as well.
So whether your ancestors were convicts, and we didn't have convicts in Victoria, but a lot of ex-convicts from Tasmania came over for the gold rush or down from Sydney Cove, or whether they were part of the gold rush, which brought the great influx of people into our community, or whether you were from Asia or from Ireland from the potato famine, or Scotland from the land clearances, or post-war, World War I, part of the great flow of humanity out of Europe, and even a greater one after World War II, or people from Turkey, or people from wherever in the world. Even if this was not your point of arrival, this can be your point of research. Is that what you're telling us?
This can not only be your point of research, this can also be your home away from home. Because we are telling stories of migration. We're telling timeless stories. We're telling your story, each and every one here in the audience as well. No doubt we'll have at least an ancestor who was a migrant to our great country, if you're not a migrant yourself. So this space really tells your story. It's a space that we want you to belong.
Can we just go really dangerously here, Rohini? Let's conduct an experiment. Mm-hmm. What do you reckon? There's about 250, 300 people here. How many of you have your ancestors from Anglo-Saxon heritage, if you put your hands up? And there's about half the audience. How many of you claim ancestors from somewhere in, say, the Middle East or Eastern Europe, if you put your hand up? And there's about, 10%, maybe not even. What if your ancestors are from Greater Asia and that's where you claim your heritage from? We've got about another 10, more than 10, 20% of the audience. Rohini puts her hand up rapidly too. What if we left out the Americas? And, one, two. Oh, no, you're just scratching your nose. What have we left out? What other inputs are we missing out on?
Europe.
Oh, goodness. How could we forget Europe? Well, so Central Europe, Italian, Greek, German, French, and up go the remaining hands, and there's another 20% there. So there's just in this audience, this gathering of Melburnians today, there's a cross-section of our community. We haven't talked about Africa. Migrants from Africa, one. Okay, and given the Gandhi connection, that's a very important connection to make as well. So there we have a cross-section in a slice straight away of contemporary Melbourne life.
Absolutely. That's why I say that, you know, this museum tells our story. And we would invite each and every one of you to come and be part of the museum's community, to make it a place where you feel a sense of belonging, a place where you have your voice heard. This is a museum that will amplify the discourse on the big issues of our time. It's a place that connects us all across all cultures. It's a place that you can come to learn about new cultures. You know, so I think that museums today play a very, very different role in society, together with our great educational institutions and our other, you know, arts institutions. So be part of the museum is my message to you.
And it's also apparently a great forum for people. You can put on functions in here too, which is a great thing to do. It's a great space. Congratulations. Ladies and gentlemen, could you say thank you to Rohini for making us so welcome here today? We've barely touched on the exhibition, but I'm about to do that with the curator and our special first guest. Ela Gandhi is a peace activist. She was a social worker. She's the granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi and was for 10 years a member of the South African Parliament between 1994 and 2004. Could you make her very welcome here? Ela, thank you very much for joining us on stage at the Immigration Museum. Tell us about your grandfather.
Well, in this museum, the importance is that my grandfather was an immigrant as well. For 21 years, he lived in South Africa, and in 1914, he returned to India. Permanently, but he sent my dad to continue with his work in South Africa, and so we were all born in South Africa.
But you did spend some time with him in India.
Yes, I did.
Memories do you have?
Okay, my family went to India during 1946 and 47, and during that time I and my brother spent about 3 months. I spent 3 months with him. My brother was a little older than me, and he spent more time with my grandfather. But the 3 months that I spent with him were absolutely wonderful. I have that memory, which I cherish deeply, of a very, very warm grandfather, someone who gave us undivided attention. And almost daily we used to have time with him. And if you know the 46-47 period, when he was very, very busy with, and not only busy, but troubled as well, because there was the whole question of the partition of India, which was very, very deeply hurtful for him, because he didn't really like India to be partitioned into two.
With the Muslim population heading to Pakistan, the Hindu population of what became Pakistan heading back into India, tens of millions of people being displaced in both directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then all the violence that went with that and the bitterness that arose from it, it deeply affected my grandfather. And during that time, he still found the time to spend with me and with some of the other children who were living on the ashram with him. And we, as little children, didn't realize what a terrible time that was. For us, you know, we weren't aware. We weren't conscious of the of what was happening. And so, you know, now when I think of it, and I think of the time that he gave us, and not only that, but when I came back to South Africa, and that was like 1 month before he was assassinated, he wrote letters to us. He wrote to my brother, he wrote to me. And I was only 7 years old, but he found the time to write letters to us.
What did he say?
Well, to me, he said, because I was very talkative. So he said that sometimes it's a good thing to be silent.
Just not in the next 43 minutes, please.
Yeah. So it was a lovely, lovely letter, which is in the National Gandhi Museum in Delhi. We gave all our memorabilia to them to look after. And this letter is there. When I go to Delhi, I read it, and it brings tears to my eyes.
I'm sure we can all understand that. If you could have a conversation with him now, what would you ask him?
Well, I would ask him how he would use the new technology.
What, you need help?
I know that's
excuse me, Mahatma Gandhi, can you help me? I can't connect to the cloud, you know.
A lot of people of my age are still struggling to deal with the new technology. But knowing how Gandhiji, without the technology, was able to communicate with so many millions of people all over the world. And if you look at the Salt March, not only do we have photographs, but stories of the Salt March that were, you know, sent out all over the world. And if you look at the fact that he had a, you know, footage of the Salt March as well, and this was in 1930, at a time when, you know, there wasn't this much of technology. How did he manage to do all that? And how much more could he have done if he had the technology that we have today?
Ila Gandhi, tell us about living in the Phoenix settlement. It's now becoming a World Heritage Site as well. What was it like growing up there?
Well, you know, my parents took the cue from my grandfather. They were sent to South Africa to continue his work, and there were three things. One is to keep the settlement in terms of the principles of simplicity, of truth, of shared spirituality, of good neighborliness, of diversity, respecting diversity, and of looking after the environment. So environment was a huge issue at the Phoenix settlement. And so for me, the very fact that we lived there in a place where there was no electricity, there was no running water, we had to depend on a borehole and water from the rain that we used to get in a tank. So we understood the value of water. We understood the value of the resources that God gives us and how to conserve those resources. So today when we hear the stories of how the environmental degradation is affecting communities, it brings back the memory of what my grandfather had taught on the Phoenix settlement.
Albert Einstein famously said that generations to come will not believe that a man such as this ever walked the earth. Why do you think he said that?
I think Gandhiji's ideas were well beyond his time. They are actually timeless, and they will still continue for generations to come and be relevant for new, generations. So I think that is what, caused him to say that his ideas will be.
What do you think he would make of the India of today? Do you think he would be proud of how it's turned out, or would he be disappointed?
I think a lot of people are disappointed, not only with India of today, but the world of today. I think there are lots of issues, particularly the rising inequalities that we see in every country, the poverty, the exploitation of people, of the environment, of resources. People are not, heeding the warnings that my grandfather gave us so many years ago, that if we don't control our desire to possess as much as we can, future generations are not going to have the resources of the world. And we don't know how they will survive. Today we are already seeing that. And therefore, I think that those are some of the things that would disappoint my grandfather.
We'll introduce the curator of the exhibition in a moment, but just still with your grandfather, he led mass movements, large numbers, huge numbers of people mobilized out on the streets to force governments to change. What would he make of the populism that is sweeping so much of the world and which is forcing governments or electing governments of a quite different complexion from even a decade ago in so much of Europe, in North America, all sorts of countries around the world?
I don't think my grandfather would be very happy with populism, because populism of its own is something that just arouses emotion in people, and there's no reasoning. For my grandfather, reasoning was a very important thing. That, firstly, you must abide by the truth. And truth can be different for each person. You have to discover the truth. It's not, that easy to say what is the truth. So he would think carefully before he does anything. And if you look at his life, he spent more time doing community work than engaging in political activity. those engagements in political activity were just about 5 or 6 times in his lifetime that he engaged in these mass actions. The rest of the time he spent educating, developing the community, making the community self-sufficient, giving back people dignity, the value of having dignity, the value of cherishing principles and values, common values that we all have, teaching people that diversity is important. Diversity can teach us a lot of things, and we can learn from each other. Diversity shouldn't be regarded as being a threat, which is what many of us regard diversity as. We feel that, you know, anyone who is different from us are a threat. And he said that it's not like that. We need to understand each other and learn from each other. We teach and we learn. It's not a one-way thing, it's a two-way thing.
And just last question before we invite our next guest to join us. Do we run the risk of turning him into some sort of a saint? Do we run the risk of saying, well, this man was perfect? And no man, no human being, no person is perfect.
Absolutely. And that's why this exhibition is so important. If you look at the exhibition, it's about when he came to South Africa. When he came to South Africa, he was 23 years old. And you'll see his photographs with beautiful tailored clothes and so on, because he, at that time, had many hang-ups. He loved his clothes. He loved fashion.
The best Savile Row tailors, the best hat, the best gloves, the best shoes.
Right, absolutely.
Yep.
And he wasn't gender sensitive. He thought that he should be the boss in the house and his wife must listen. But his wife was a very strong person. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of information on her, but it is important to remember that she was a woman in her own right and taught Gandhiji a lot of lessons. So in the 21 years that he lived in South Africa, he transformed. And that's why he writes about My Experiments with Truth. That's his autobiography. So he was an ordinary human being who changed, consciously changed. And therefore, you know, the story is that all of us can change. We have to see what is wrong with us and be able to change it. And so it's work in progress. And with Gandhiji, he said it's work in progress right until the time he passed on.
And as they always remind us, behind every successful man is an astonished woman.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ila Gandhi. And Ila, stay with us because we've got much to talk about where your insights, your experience and your knowledge will be invaluable for us. Rohini Kapadat, the General Manager of the Immigration Museum, is our host and my co-host. And a special exhibition here on Mahatma Gandhi at the Immigration Museum brings us here. It's been put together by Gandhi specialist Birad Yanik, who's a trustee of the Indira Gandhi National Centre for the Arts in New Delhi and also the convener of the Digital Museum in Hyderabad, which much of this material has been sourced from. Birad, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You've almost become the storyteller for much of this remarkable man's life. How do you pick out which bits of such an extraordinary archive, which bits best tell the story?
I was just mentioning last evening that the collective works of Mahatma Gandhi are 98 volumes. The number of photographs have not been documented yet. I'm sure they'll cross a few thousand. So definitely it is a task which cannot be completed in a lifetime to read all about it. But the philosophy that we have used is try to keep it very simple, try to stick to the basics, because one of the learnings that we've had from Mahatma Gandhi's life is if you want to cause positive change, mass change, keep it simple.
Bira, that's what's been really exciting about this whole journey with you as well, and thank you so much for bringing this exhibition to Melbourne. The work that we've done in collaboration, you know, between the collaboration between Museums Victoria and the Gandhi Digital Museum has been quite a transformative experience for us as well. And I think the word transformation sits at the center of this whole exhibition. Tell us as well, how has this experience in bringing this exhibition here transformed your own idea of telling this story to the rest of the world?
To be honest, when I first walked into this museum, I was quite excited because looking at the size of the building. But when I walked into this room, the long room, it overwhelmed me. You know, I've worked in museums which have got ceiling heights of, you know, 15 feet. And over here, looking at something almost 40, it's almost three floors. The room has got an identity of its own. And if you have to put an exhibition over here, you'll really have to do something very different. Although, when you have Gandhi with you, anything is possible. So I think one of the challenges for us was the location. But at the same time, we had some great help from Museums Victoria. Their conservation team actually taught us a thing or two about conserving the material that we have. In fact, all the material was shipped over here, and it went through a process of curation, of preservation, and then it was laid out over here. And when we came in, we came in with all our digital equipment, we came in with all our software, with all our interactivity, but we used local suppliers over here to build it over here. It was built in Melbourne.
Did it work when you turned it on? Because if it didn't, you could have called the helpline, which probably would have been back in India.
In fact, the helpline right now is working in India.
What's really exciting is that everything that you see, you know, all the production, that's been locally produced. The photographs have been printed here as well. And the Museums Victoria exhibition team has done a remarkable job in working so closely with the Gandhi Digital Museum to actually put the physical spaces. And what must be highlighted too is are those figures that you see on the side. They are the Puna figures made of clay. They've actually come out of the Museums Victoria collection. They were last shown at the Melbourne Court, or the Indian Court, I think it's called, at the Royal Exhibition Hall more than 100 years ago.
So they've been... When Melbourne hosted the World's Exhibition.
That's right.
In the exhibition building.
That's right.
Yep.
Over 100 years ago, and they've just come out for the first time in a long while. But they work with this exhibition so beautifully because they tell the story of Gandhi's India. So I'd invite you to take a look at those figures.
Okay, now one of the things I learned, Birad, and I'm sure Ela may want to have a word on this as well, Gandhi went through quite a change in his own views. In his early years in South Africa, he wanted the Indians in South Africa to be treated more like white folk rather than like Africans. In fact, it wasn't that he wanted everyone to be treated the same, he just wanted Indians to be treated better, but not Africans. How do we fit that in with the story of this man who we deify almost in later life? How do we adjust to understand the process he must have gone through himself from those attitudes earlier in life? How do we do that, Ela?
Okay. In those early days, he was representing the Indian community. The reason why he came to South Africa was because he was invited by a businessman, Indian businessman, to represent him in a case.
And as a lawyer, as a barrister.
Yeah. And a year later, he found that the Indian community, which had a qualified vote, and that qualified vote was going to be taken away from the Indian community. And so those statements that he made then were about that qualified vote. Later in life, he realized that firstly, a qualified vote is not what we are looking for. We want freedom. We don't want qualified votes. And so, he didn't agree with that, even though he had fought for it in South Africa in those early days. Later on in life, he actually said to people that the real freedom in South Africa is when the majority of the people of Africa, of South Africa, would be able to be free, to be liberated, to have power to determine what is to be done in the country.
So that personal transformation from being, was he, can I call him a dandy? Would that be fair? When he arrived, he was this young, successful man with Savile Row suits who had qualified and had the most beautifully English-style way of speaking. He was magnificent in his attire, not at all what we identify with later in life, the man in the simple robes and the bare chest and the sandals. So he went through this personal transformation. And if Gandhi could go through that process of transformation and, dare I say it, even enlightenment, is the lesson that we all can too if we ask ourselves the right questions. Absolutely. Is that what it's about?
Yes. I think that that is the meaning of life. If any of us believe that we remain the same, that what we believe in today, we are going to continue to believe in it, then I think there's a stubbornness that we attribute to ourselves.
And it's very, a lot of uncomfortable people here squirming in their seats and standing where they are going, I can relate to that. I know I am. Come on. Fess up, ladies and gentlemen.
So the reality of life is that we learn new things every day of our lives. As we communicate with people, as we see new things, we learn new things. And we then decide, make a decision, what part of those things are we going to take into our lives? So you don't just look at new things and it just bumps off your head. You think about it and you imbibe it in your life. And that is what makes life. That's what makes life interesting. And that is what is the beauty of life. I just want you to see this picture here and this picture here.
The two pictures that are the bookends of our little stage here, yes. One of Gandhi is a very young man, very dapper, with a full head of hair and a lush moustache. And on the other side, still a lush moustache, but the much more commonly recognised picture of an old man wrapped in a simple robe with his famous circular glasses. Yes? Mm. So these two pictures.
And the dressing has changed.
Totally.
Totally, yeah.
It's so that also
one of the visual transformation in his life. But in his thinking was also a change. And, in 1913, he began to talk about women's position, the power that women had. And he encouraged the women in South Africa to participate in the Defiance campaign. Prior to 1913, all the campaigns were led by men alone. There were no women involved in it. In 1913, he encouraged the women, and the women were ready to participate. There's a little quote in our museum where my grandmother, Kasturba, says that I have nothing to think about. I am ready to participate in this defiance campaign.
So, Birat, on this transformation,
one of the things I'd like to point out when visitors come to this museum is you'll see these larger-than-life images of Mahatma Gandhi. In fact, one of the styles that we curated this was, you can actually see his transformation in the images. For example, the first image that you would come across would be, and that's the history wall where we have, is his on his return to India. That was the photograph taken. And notice the turban, notice the amount of clothing he has. It's all khadi, it's all white. But as he transformed in India over the later years, he starts giving up the clothing, one by one. Finally, when he's doing the salt march, he's only in the loincloth. He says, I will wear only what a poor Indian can afford. So you can see it, his transformation in his clothing too, when you go across this exhibition. And I said, larger than life. You know, there was a young gentleman who asked me, he says, Mahatma Gandhi believed in nonviolence. Then why does he have a stick in his hand? You know, and if you look at the picture of the 1913 march, and if you look at the picture of the 1930 march also, he's got a stick. The answer that we had for that child was, Mahatma Gandhi said, I have the ability to hit you. I choose not to hit you. That is nonviolence.
It's a bit like the definition of a gentleman. Did you know that one? Someone who knows how to play the bagpipes but chooses not to.
But, you know, what I've really enjoyed about the work that we've all done together is the fact that we are on a mission to find the next Gandhi. We're on a mission to ignite the spirit of Gandhi, not just tell the story of Gandhi. Our invitation to everybody that visits this exhibition is, you know, have you considered what you might do for the world around you? How you might be the change that you seek in this world? And I think that's a really powerful message.
No, I totally agree. In fact, I'd just like to take you back to the conversation we were having with Ila Gandhi in the car last evening when we were driving back. And I think the point that she made was extremely important. She said that the time has come when we talk not as we, us. The time has come to take responsibility for our statements and say, I am going to do this. I believe in this. I stand by this proof, and I have made the statement. With today, the social media, with the amount of news and the amount quickly we can do forwards and shares, I think that was very important learning for me last evening.
That's right. So, and we were talking about how we can sometimes hide behind that sense of, oh, they say this and, you know, so, etc. Whereas taking personal responsibility for your viewpoint is now becoming more and more important.
So it's up to each one of us to live true to these values. Birad, thank you very much for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, could you thank Birad?
Thank you so much.
Birad Yanik, author, photographer, Gandhi specialist, curator of the Mahatma Gandhi Digital Museum in Hyderabad. And if you want to have a look online, you'll learn much more about it. In a moment, we'll be joined by two young local aspiring Gandhijis, perhaps, people who are in our community practicing these very sorts of values. But Ila Gandhi, as we look around, as we learn from this exhibition, what do you want people to take away? What do you want people to go away with from the experience of learning about your grandfather, but also the lessons that he passed on to other generations, including his granddaughter, to you?
Well, I think, firstly, to look at the exhibition and see what resonates with you. Because I think that the young people are the future of the world. And they have to decide whether they still want to go the way the older people have gone or whether they want to change the world and how they want to change it. So I think the challenge for the young people is to, first of all, find those principles and those ideas that resonate with you. The second issue is that Gandhiji said that you can't ask anybody to do something if you're not prepared to do it yourself. So you must be first prepared to do it yourself before you can take that message to anyone else. And so one needs to say, okay, this idea resonates with me. How do I apply it in my life? And then you take that message forward and become the ambassador of that message. So even if there are three things or four things that you take away from this exhibition and then apply it to yourself and become ambassadors to take those messages to the world, I think it would be wonderful and it would make a change in the world.
Well, I'm not sure the world can deal with all the change that's needed all at once, because by golly, there's a lot that's not going right at the moment. Yeah. Although I might say, when I saw the North and South Korean leaders shake hands the other day, I pinched myself. I wondered if it was actually happening. And then as you saw it there, you thought, well, if that's really what's just happened, and it has, we've seen it with our own eyes, well, practically anything would seem to be possible. And if Donald Trump wants a Nobel Peace Prize, well, he can damn well have one. I really don't care as long as we don't have nuclear war. Hey? Anyway, let's not get distracted
by
that.
That was a moment of great hope.
It was extraordinary, wasn't it?
Extraordinary, absolutely, John.
Or, as some of the North Korean supporters say, the only reason you're all so confused is because you've completely misunderstood North Korea and swallowed all the propaganda about them in the first place. I mean, I've just been reading a book about North Korea which made me think they're even worse than they've been described. But there you go. I mean, my parents weren't kidnapped from a beach in Japan and imprisoned so that they could learn about Western culture the way so many people were. So that's not my family story, but there's plenty in Japan for whom it is.
But, you know, it gave me the sense as well, though, that if we bring our shared humanity to bear, that things can change towards the good just as fast as they can tumble towards the bad. So why not put our energy towards the good side?
Which is, as much as anything, what an immigration museum is about. It's about those shared experiences. What, for instance, the issues that are being dealt with in our community now with the most recently arrived groups, the African community, are the same as the previous groups have dealt with, going all the way back to the Irish, the Scots, the post-war refugees, the people out of Tiananmen Square, the refugees from Asia or Vietnam from the conflict after the American War, or the Vietnam War as we call it, the American War as they call it, and on it goes. The experiences are universal, aren't they?
Absolutely. I think that this is the time we've got to now, you know, just stop, take a breath, and perhaps change course. And if we do that in a deliberate way, together, we can actually move towards the right direction. Because the world has been going off course for the last several years. And we know that we're not heading in the right direction. But we know that when we're in the hands of such capable leaders, like the next generation, whose value systems seem to be completely on point, then, you know, there is hope for the world.
In fact, the sooner we hand over to them, the better, I reckon. Rohini Kapadat is General Manager here and our host at the Immigration Museum. Ela Gandhi is with us on the stage. I'm John Fain. You're on ABC Radio Melbourne, and we have with us two young community leaders from diverse communities in order to pick up and carry the baton to the next generation. Well, that's the plan anyway. Daisy Mann is Program Manager at Spark Deakin. She's a community bank director and founder of a social enterprise collective and is one of those young up-and-comers. Daisy, good morning to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
As you have a look around this exhibition, what impression does it make on you? How much did you know about Mahatma Gandhi?
At first, it's also my second visit to the Immigration Museum. The first was last night because of this exhibition. I think he's done phenomenal work, and the exhibition, the images, the collections probably haven't even done justice to his life. As he said, how many volumes he's produced, I had no idea. So it's quite eye-opening, I think.
So as you have a look at what that stage, what that snapshot in history is all about, do you connect it or relate it to where you see the world today?
I do, and I do on a personal level as well. I think the exhibition's really been helpful, and I think, Ella, you touched on this around his personal transformation. That's been phenomenal. I mean, people have a lot of views about Gandhi, and it's interesting, for the first time I got to learn through this exhibition that he transformed, and personal transformation, I think, really resonates with myself and our community.
So if you started off being generous, compassionate and full of humanity, do you transform into a complete horrible, nasty, evil.
If you watch too much TV, maybe.
You can transform the other way just as easily, can't you? Our other young future leader is Ahmed Hassan. Ahmed, good morning to you.
Good morning to
you,
John.
Thank you for joining us. He's a member of Victoria Police's African Australian Community Task Force and co-founder of a thing called the Youth Activating Youth Forum. Tell us about that, Ahmed. What does it do?
Youth Activating Youth is a multicultural organisation that assists disadvantaged multicultural youth, young people who come from low socioeconomic backgrounds that have obviously that are facing barriers such as, you know, employment, education, and various other barriers, and to help them get over the line. And what I've been doing very closely for the past year or so has been trying to deal with a lot of the problems that have been brewing in the media, especially with the African community, and how do we downplay that and look at the underlying issues? And that's something that we can learn from Gandhi and his values. He's showing, you know, empathy, showing brotherly love to others, you know, bringing others in, you know, showing compassion.
Okay, so there's another incident just in the last few days on the weekend, a party in North Melbourne. A bunch of kids who we're told are from the African community take out an Airbnb on a home.
Yep.
Some poor landlord who's had their house trashed, a couple of police cars have been trashed, and everyone's suddenly screaming out again, what's wrong with African kids? How come they don't get it?
Look, what we have to look at is what are the underlying issues. Look, young people want to celebrate and obviously party and come together. No one disagrees against that. But what we should look is the African community and the leaders that we've been discussing over some time is we don't agree with crime. Look, any young person that does commit crime does deserve to face the full force of the law. But many of these young people come from families, large families, so, you know, 8-plus kids, you know, and there are a lot of issues that are brewing within the family. Some young kids are, you know, facing substance abuse, you know, lack of education. They're not in any form of community. What we need to do as the wider community is how do we bring them into our soccer clubs? How do we bring them to our inner community?
And how do we?
Look, I think it's first trying to break that stigma, us against them, and try to say, yes, we are all Australians. Most of these kids, about 75% of these kids are born in this country. There are Australians, you know.
They know that the police are the police and that's the law.
Absolutely.
If the police tell you to do something, you're supposed to do it, not jump on their car and smash the windscreen.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I agree with what the police have done. They've come there, obviously, because over the weekend, especially, what has happened is the police came there because there was, you know, a lot of noise, the neighbours complained. Young people shouldn't have reacted in that manner, okay? And that's one of the things we're discussing tonight, part of the task force meeting that we have with Victoria Police, is what can the leaders do? What can we do to actually, you know, break the stigma and break this cycle of young people reoffending? Is it programs? Is it youth engagement? What do we need to be put
in? And can I just commend the brilliant work of the Victoria Police in this area? And we recently ran at the Immigration Museum a forum on African gangs, but this was run by the Monash University as well. And we heard great examples of African female leaders running programs such as bringing a basketball team together of youth who have offended, but getting them to play a game together with the Victoria Police team. So these are great examples of hope in our community. And congratulations, Ahmed, for doing the work that you do. I've seen Ahmed over the last couple of years really been very active in this space. And we need leaders like you to step up and help solve these problems.
Yeah, thank you, Rini. But what we have to look at is also how can the wider community contribute to these young people's lives. Look, for myself, what I do is how can I transform these young people that have come through the youth justice system? How can I build their capacity and make them the next generation of young leaders? How can I build their capacity and mentor them? We really have to look at giving them a second chance and trying to make sure that they contribute to society in a positive manner.
All right. And Daisy, what sort of work are you doing with young people? Because you're more on the business and entrepreneurial side of things.
So I manage Deakin University's Spark Innovation Program, which is where we help entrepreneurs. So we provide them with seed funding, we provide them with support, office space, so that's our accelerator program. But I'm personally also in the program. We're very passionate about diversity, and it comes up regularly. I mean, we looked last year at all the startups and entrepreneurs we're funding, and we actively acknowledge that we had a lack of diversity there. So this year we've made so many changes. What is it? Why, for instance, why aren't women applying to some of our programs? It's a pipeline. And one thing, the first thing I asked was, is it a pipeline issue or is it a selection process issue? Is it that we're at the top, we're only picking young white males to lead our next tech startups? Or is there a pipeline? For us, it was a pipeline issue, meaning that just applicants right at the bottom weren't, at the first level, weren't coming through. So we've implemented quite a bit to make sure that we get that.
What about the unconscious bias that we've heard so much about, where when people are employing a young person, they choose someone who they can relate to rather than someone from a community they're not comfortable or familiar with?
Unconscious bias is huge, and it's so difficult to, you know, to personally like transform, to change that. Sheryl Sandberg, who's the Chief Operating Officer of Facebook, has a great talk, Why There's Too Few Women in Leadership. And that talk's really inspired me and to look at my own unconscious bias as well. I mean, for a very long time, I think I used to say, oh, I just get along with men, it's easier to work with them and this and that. And I had to check myself and say, no, that's not the right way to approach this. So even with diversity on boards is one way to address it. I mean, one of the boards I serve on as well, I'm probably the only person there from a different community and probably the only person there under 55. So I look around and I think all the views that diversity brings to a board is that they resonate with the communities they've come from, and it's really important at that level.
Well, we're seeing, Rohini, you come from a business background, we're seeing how well corporate Australia is serving our public interest at the moment, aren't we? AMP, Commonwealth Bank, Telstra, Ford, $10 million fine here, $1 billion assurance there.
I think the right things are happening. The Royal Commission's unearthed some important facts. We're all in the know. I'm here to talk about the museums, though, and I think that... Museums are here actually as these hidden treasures, and they exist only if they enrich lives. They're here to enrich your life. And we want to make sure that we open our doors and welcome all communities and offer them a safe space in which they can come and express their tremendous magic.
So, Eli, here you are. You've flown into Melbourne. You have spent most of your life in South Africa, and telling us the fundamental truths of the lessons that we learn from your famous grandfather. You hear some of the young leaders, and we're hearing from Daisy, we're hearing from Ahmed about their ideas for the future. What message do you give to them?
I think a very important message for the young people today and for the world is that we should make every attempt to stick to non-violent methods. Because at the end of the day, if you look at non-violent methods, they produce much better results. Because with non-violence, you try to transform. You don't try to conquer somebody. Whereas with violent methods, you are now saying that I have got the power and I'm going to conquer you. And once you do that, there's always an opponent, there's always bitterness, a victim who has lost the battle, and a conqueror who has won the battle. And there'll always be that antagonism between the two. Whereas with nonviolent methods, the result is very good, because both parties would always remain friendly and would always be prepared to discuss things with each other.
So the message, Ahmed, is that instead of organising basketball games with the police, you should be playing frisbee.
I wish the police were that friendly to play frisbee with us. But no, there is a real lesson here, and this is what the task force is obviously done, is easing the tensions between community and Victoria Police. And I'd like to end with this, is let's all look at the underlying issues rather than looking at the media.
Yeah. Ahmed Hassan and Daisy Mann, ladies and gentlemen, could you thank them both? And an extra big thank you, please. An extra big thank you to Ela Gandhi, Rohini Kapadat, and Rohini, thank you for your hospitality, and we encourage everybody to come and visit the Immigration Museum. The Mahatma Gandhi exhibition is on until the 15th of July. And thank you all, ladies and gentlemen, for coming along.